You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. When you hear the word opera, what do you think of? Perhaps over-the-top dramas involving passionate love, betrayal, honor, and tragic death? And of course, fabulous soaring music? Well, it's all there in the Santa Fe Opera production of Puccini's Madame Butterfly. Pack up a picnic and tailgate before the performance, or sign up for dinner and a pre-opera lecture. To learn more and to purchase tickets, visit santafeopera.org. You can also call the box office at 800-280-4654 or locally at 505-986-5900. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. As you know, if you're living here in Santa Fe, we had a warm winter and we didn't get enough snow. The snow brings the water we need, and as a result, New Mexico's drought is currently among the worst in the United States. As the summer heats up, water restrictions in Santa Fe will be coming into effect, and we're being called upon to renew our conservation efforts and learn more about what we can do to value our water. Visit facebook.com/SaveWaterSantaFe to take the City of Santa Fe's new drought online quiz and learn not just about the current condition of the drought, but also how to contribute to long-term efforts to maintain a healthy, green, and water-wise Santa Fe. I'm very happy now to welcome Kenny Mann and Chief Nixon Parmisa, who is a Maasai assistant chief. They are both part of an organization called Acacia Moyo. They are here in Santa Fe on the occasion of Folk Art Market. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So one of the things that you are both involved in is wildlife conservation and basically environmental conservation in the Nairobi area of Kenya. Tell us about that, how this whole initiative began.
The wildlife conservation has been going on for a very long time, and Mr. Parmisa will fill you in about that. Acacia Moyo is a relatively new organization, which I am one of the founders of, and the other founder is Anthony Carlson, who lives in Santa Fe, which is why we're here. I'm born and raised in Kenya, actually a mile away from where Nixon lives is where I was born, among the Maasai. So I've always considered the Maasai my closest people, in a way. And I've also understood over the years how much we can learn from people like the Maasai and other indigenous groups. So Acacia Moyo formed to help link the traditions that the Maasai community in this area called Kitengela, which is very close to Nairobi, already has with wildlife and their own survival, because there's an equation that has to be made, which is the Maasai community is very impoverished. They own a great deal of livestock. Everybody has large numbers of cows, sheep, and goats. That's the wealth. That livestock requires a lot of land for grazing. They occupy the same territory that the wildlife occupies. This area is just on the southern border of Nairobi National Park, which is an unfenced open border, deliberately so that the wildlife has what's called a dispersal area. So when you come to visit Mr. Parmisa in Kitengela, you are surrounded by wildlife, even though you're not actually in the game park. So the Maasai have learned how to coexist with the livestock and the wildlife. However, because the community is poor, many families are often forced to sell off pieces of land. And when a piece of land is sold, almost always the new owner will fence it in. This means that the livestock has lost some grazing. The wildlife has lost some grazing. It also plays havoc with the migration routes for the wildlife. And without land, the Maasai lose their community. So the equation that we're trying to make is to link the Maasai community with wildlife conservation in order that they can survive where they are and not be forced to sell off the land. So we're in partnership with a well-based Kenya organization called the Wildlife Foundation, which exists in the same area. They have a kind of learning compound right where we are. We have an office in their compound. Their focus is on training local people to be rangers and giving education on conservation. They're getting students from England and other countries to come and help. So that's that side of it. Acacia Moyo focuses on working with the Maasai to develop sustainable income-producing activities so that they can earn a living and not have to sell off the land. That's our job.
One of the things that you have talked about, Mr. Parmisa, is that the three elements, interrelated elements of livestock, wildlife, and culture really make the Maasai community. How does that work? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, as we said, Maasai, where we're living now, we've been living in that area for nearly 4,000 years. And we've been living with these three things, the wildlife, the community, and our culture. And our culture has taught us so many things and even shaped our life on how to coexist with wildlife, because wildlife and livestock are one thing. It's only that there are some that we keep them at home, and there are some that we keep them in the bush. But they are all, we feel like we all own all of them, and it's our responsibility as a community to protect them. We sometimes have challenges with the interaction and the conflict sometimes, but we've come to learn that the conflict is a seasonal problem. And when you have a season problem with your neighbor, that does not make that neighbor to be your enemy. It's a season, it goes, and then the other season comes and life goes on. So we've always been able to protect wildlife because wildlife and livestock are one. And our culture taught us even to be able to look some things like even the forest. If, for example, in my culture, if you kill an animal, you'll be given a very bad name. You'll be called a dorobo. Eldorobo is someone who is one of the community within the Maasai who are gatherers and hunters. So you kind of isolated because you are doing something contrary to what the community wants. And the other thing that is really important is the land, because all these animals, our wildlife, the livestock and the culture need land to practice all these things. And of late we've been seeing is the challenges that face the same land. And there are a number of reasons why we are facing the challenges of the land, and the wildlife is also facing the same challenges. One is because of human population. Number two is because of the poor policy that are created without involving the local community, without having the community be part of the decision making, and those policies come and affect us. I remember back in our community, one day the government came up with the so-called the Metropolitan. So we were told that where we live in the bush is now part of the Nairobi. What does that mean? That means you are telling someone in Nairobi, in the city, that you can go to Kitengela and you can buy a land there and we will consider you as a Nairobian. And because the land is cheaper, many people comes. So when we have all this influx of the people from the city moving into our area, and there is no proper land use plan to control development within that particular area, then all this uncontrolled development end up messing the whole dispersal area. And this is a very critical, important area in terms of conservation in the whole country. Because even after independent, even before independent, when the Nairobi National Park was gazetted as the first protected area in Kenya, Kitengela area was declared as a conservation area. But the mistake they did is they never gazetted that area as a protected area. So it's a very important area in terms of conservation because it links very important conservation areas like Amboseli, Maasai Mara, and Nairobi National Park. So, it's very important. So all these things are together and they cannot be separated. If you separate one, the whole triangle collapses.
There are Maasai customs, rules, laws that are part of your social fabric. Then there's presumably Kenyan rules and laws. How do they interact and what do you do when there are conflicts?
Yeah, mostly the decision at the community level is done by the local community. And community mostly make decision on what they want. But sometimes we have very challenging issues when some of the approach and decision are made through a top-down approach, because they are being enforced and pushed down to us. And sometimes it takes a long time even for community to understand and be able to accept them. So sometimes you have all this resistance from the local community, but at times the local community decide on what to do. Sometimes they come up with their own ways and decide on what to do. But I think That's when now the leadership is required to be able to involve the community in every decision that is being made, especially things that really will directly affect the life of the people in the villages.
One of the things that you have talked about is the importance of maintaining traditional culture and at the same time abandoning practices that are outdated or that you no longer want, like underage marriage and female genital mutilation, and also things like initiation through hunting lions, which you're now kind of doing the opposite.
Mm.
Talk about what is the process by which you abandon or get rid of long-standing traditions.
Yeah, I think those are some of the issues that we are actually dealing now in the community. And the reason is we believe that some of these things are taking the community backward. If you talk of, for example, the early marriage of underage girl, if you take this young girl and marry off, by the time she is at the age of 12 or 15, by the time probably she will be 19 or 18 or even 16, she has a baby. So it's like you are completely destroying the future of that particular child. And maybe that child is married to a polygamous family. So some of these practices we are saying no. If you must marry, then you have to marry a person who has already gone to school, finished the school, and above the required age. Some of these practices, like the female genital mutilation, is just like humiliating them, and you're just showing that they don't have a right to say what they want to should be done to them. So some of these practices we do hold what we call in Kenya barazas, like a community gathering, and we say some of these practices we don't want. In fact, we've gone to that level that we've influenced the national government to come up with laws. If now you marry an underage girl, you'll be arrested. If you involve in the female genital mutilation, the doctor, the parents, they all go to jail because that's now what the law says. And some of these practices, like, for example, killing lion, we are telling the young people that if you want to kill a lion, then the first lion you should kill is to have a university degree. And we will only celebrate you and be proud of you if you come with so many degrees than come with the number of lion. Because when you kill lion, you are killing the economy of the country. And to me, that's economic sabotage. Because we have tourists all over the world who are coming to see those lions. And after all doing this and talking to the local community and shows them, yes, this was our culture, but there is a more better way we can do it and even be proud in many ways and be even known all over the world than just kill lion. And some of the many young people now accept what we are saying. And we've seen now with the recent increase in the number of lions from, like in Nairobi National Park, from 2003, there were 9 lions. Now we have over 45 lions and we know them by the names and we can always tell that this one is a lion that from which particular pride. And because now we involve the community in, you know, be part of the conservation than just isolating them and, you know, let them do what they want. We bring them to be part of our team that do all these kind of things. So when we tell them lions are good, then they know all these reasons and they also develop interest now to protect and conserve them.
One of the things that you do is instead of hunting a lion as an initiation, you save a lion. Hunting a lion, that makes sense. You go out and hunt a lion. How do you save a lion? What does that actually look like?
There are a number of things that we do. One is monitoring. Whenever they are outside the park, if, for example, they end up killing a cow, one thing you do is you identify that lion. And maybe if it repeats twice or three times, then we advise the Kenya Wildlife Service, maybe, for example, to collar them. So the lion will be fitted with a tracking satellite, and then we can always see their movement outside the park. And when they are out, and probably we advise them that maybe this particular lion, because it has been to be a trouble lion, in quote, can be pushed back to the park, because if it stays out in the community, keeps attacking livestock. So that's actually one of the things. We monitor them. And number two is we report every time there is an incident, they are outside the park or in areas where we think that they can threaten livestock or even human life, then we report immediately to KWS. And now we pass all this information to the community. And many people now, especially the young people, are turning out now to be lion warriors, you know, and lion guardians.
Lion warriors, lion guardians.
Yes.
Now, what do lions eat besides livestock? What's their normal food?
You know, they are carnivores, so they eat meat. They eat wild beasts. They kill zebras. They eat giraffes. They kill buffaloes. I was watching on the community WhatsApp yesterday in the evening. I saw a group of six lions chasing a buffalo inside Nairobi National Park. So, and we have all these animals in our area. The only animal that we don't have is elephant. But all these other herbivores, especially like in Kenya, we have nearly 28 different species of antelopes. So all these lion food, and giraffes, buffaloes, then sometimes livestock.
If there are enough of these other animals like zebras and giraffes and buffalo, if those things, I mean, do you have to engage in conserving those animals so that the lion don't eat as much of the livestock?
Yes. I mean,
what's the balance there?
Yes, because if you don't protect the herbivores, the other herbivores, then lion will not have an alternative other than our livestock. So all of them, they are very important. And they play a very important role in a savanna ecosystem, because there are areas, for example, like buffaloes only open up those bushes during the dry season. Their dry season, wet season, and after during the rain and after the rain, there are areas that livestock cannot go just because of the thick bushes. So that's when now you need the buffaloes to open up those areas and zebras. There are some grass that grow old, and they have less nutrients, and you cannot burn them, then you need herbivores to eat them, like zebras. So you need them to clear, so by the next rain season, then you have fresh grass to grow. So all these, they are all important, and they play a very important role in an ecosystem. Each one play a different role. So they are all important. Herbivores are important because they are food to livestock, they are food to lions, and when you have enough herbivores, then lions, you have less trouble. Because in our case, in our area, for example, the human wildlife conflict is seasonal. During the wet season, most of the herbivores move outside the park and leave the park. The reason is they like to come out in a community area because grass are short, so they can, you know, easily see lions. You know, they run away from them. Number two, because of the high competition of grazing in outside the park, then after every rain season, you have new grass growing up, and new grass are known to be have more nutrients compared to the old grass that are found in a protected area where there is less human activity. So all these things, and during the dry season, most of these herbivores go back to the park, and even lions goes back to the park. So it's a very interesting thing that even now the local community understanding the ecology and the behavior of animals, and which particular time they are in this particular area, and which particular time they are not within their area.
The kinds of understandings of the larger system you're talking about are a kind of study of scientific study of ecology. Is that understanding also a part of traditional Maasai culture before there even was, you know, ecological sciences?
Yes. And in fact, most of these things, and I tend to believe that even actually those researchers and scientists now are just actually interpreting the local indigenous knowledge to put it in papers. But purely, if you read those papers, it's purely a community knowledge. These things we know because we pass even the information to our generation. Most of these things we learn from our parents, we learn from our relatives, and we learn by seeing, you know, observing these things in the field. I remember one day we were sitting somewhere in Masai Mara with one of the very known scientists. He's a molecular scientist. Actually, I think now he works in Germany. And he asked another local Masai, "Why do you think the population of warthog is small in Masai Mara?" So the guy just gave the narrative that there was a time the young people decided to start killing them using dogs just for fun, the young boys when they leave school. And then that's, you know, he thinks that's the reason why the population went down. So the next thing, the guy just went there and started writing a paper. You know, he published.
Right.
It's a paper now. And you know, so all this knowledge is there. The community have so many things in what happened in these areas. And through observing, through seeing, even the season, a local Maasai, I can tell you the behavior of wild animals and tell you whether they are predicting rain or drought. Yes, there are times you see animals very close to water area. They don't move away. They're just within that area, and they don't graze so much. It's an indication, tells you that the rain is coming. There are times when certain plants flower. You see them flowering. It's an indication of the rain. There are times you look at the position of the new moon, tells you there is no rain. So these things, by observing them, tells us to predict seasons.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take just a quick break right now to hear from our sponsors. This program is brought to you by Total Wine and More. With locations in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, each store has about 8,000 different wines from all over the world and thousands of beers, including both major brands and microbrews and imported beers. And they have more than 3,000 different kinds of spirits, all at the lowest prices you'll find, and with a trained, knowledgeable staff. They're on the web at totalwine.com, and you can order for in-store pickup. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off on your next $50 purchase. That's code 6979. Thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. And now back to our program. When you talk about the Maasai community, there are hundreds of thousands of Maasai people in Kenya. How do you share information and knowledge? Is it across the whole larger community or smaller areas like villages?
No, we have jurisdiction areas. And like myself as a community chief, I have my own jurisdiction area. I lead my community to, you know, we sit down with them and we decide what to do. And it's a big area. And I also, on the neighboring, there is also another chief and there is another one. So it's an information that is shared across the whole area. If, for example, an area that far away from you, there is an outbreak of a particular disease, you'll know even if you are far, because we have our own communication network. Like if you go to a market area, you can just decide to go to a market just to get the news of the area, what is happening. And once you get all that news, then you take the information back to your community. If we meet by the roadside, then one of the things we will be talking about, you tell me where you come from. If we go to a community meeting, even before we start the agenda of the meeting, we get the news update of the area. And then you tell us there was a cow that was killed yesterday, there was so-and-so son has got a scholarship. So we have all the network and the clear picture of the entire community. And that's how we pass the information. So the people who goes for a meeting, if they go back to their home, they pass that particular information. So the information goes across the whole area.
People might be surprised to hear that the community is incredibly savvy digitally. It was actually Mr. Pamisa who showed me WhatsApp back in Kenya. I had never heard of it. And you sell your cows or your livestock over WhatsApp. So this data gathering, you know, in these communities is not only through one-on-one interactions, but it's happening on cell phones, very aware of how this new technology actually helps to maintain traditions, right, Nixon? You told me that once, which sort of goes contrary to what most people might believe, you know. And the other point I wanted to make is that here in the United States, we are having a crisis, as everyone knows. And I think that we have so much to learn from an indigenous community such as this one, the way the community is structured, even the proverbs, perhaps Mr. Pamisa could give us an example, are so full of wisdom, and that there are people who are actually living this way and are still part of the modern world. I think that the Maasai in particular have found the solution to how do you keep your traditions and live in the modern world.
Well, when you were talking about how children learn from their parents and learn through observation, I was thinking about how so many American and European kids, especially American kids, are looking at their phones all the time. And so instead of observing those trees out there or the animals that are living in those trees or listening to what a particular bird call looks like, they're watching and listening to their phones. Mm. You're using cell phones in an appropriate way to share information that has to actually do with nature and community. But do you also have this situation of kids getting kind of addicted to the games on their phone or things like that?
Yeah, we always say back in our home is the earth is the best teacher, and there's time for everything. If, for example, you are in school, and if the schools are closed or it's a weekend, you have to go and do herding. So when you go and do herding from morning to the evening, there are so many things you learn. And we always tell the kids that this, you know, you can learn from the environment, and you can also learn from your cell phone, and time for everything. You can't just wake up in the morning having your cell phone going through. Your cell phone might show you so many things, and you might read them. But the earth and the ecosystem can teach you those things and give you a proper practice on how to, you know, some of these things, how they work. So those are the things that we really taught them. It's good to embrace the new technology, but use technology in a better way.
You've talked about livestock, cows, sheep, and goats that are very much part of the culture, the diet, and everything else. What about vegetables and grains? What are you growing? What does that look like? What is the kind of total picture of the food that you eat?
Yeah, we grow up in a society where people only believe that livestock is everything. If you want to put on your clothes, you have to sell an animal. If your kid has to go to school, someone is sick, you have to sell an animal. If you have a food, then you slaughter animals, you have them as your food. But we've come to realize that there are challenges. Sometimes we have a drought and you have to move your livestock away from your home. I remember last year alone, I moved 3 times. I went down south and then I came again and I went to the west and then I came back again. That's when we experienced rain in the beginning of this year. So when you take away all livestock from your family, you are taking the whole source of food and the whole livelihood away from your family. So one of the things actually now we had these now partnering with Acacia Moyo is how do we be able to help our community to grow food for one so that you have a sustainable way of food even during the wet season and during the dry season. And number two is to have the right, you know, because of the right nutrition. You know, you can do so many things, but if you take an hungry child to school, are you thinking of the concentration of that girl will be good, or that boy will be good? It will be very poor. So that's why now we have partnering with Acacia Moyo to see if we can be able to come up with a garden. We've already identified the area. We just need now to start training the community on how to come up with the better crops, and you know, for a particular season, for example, and then have sustainable food throughout the year. So sometimes we do practice growing crops like maize and beans during the long rain. But sometimes nowadays rains are unpredictable. You plant your crops and there is no rain. Or sometimes you plant and then you have a successful rain. The next 3 years you have a failed rain. So, but if we have now a proper way where people can do irrigation and we have a proper training for the local community now to understand that we can utilize our land to grow the food, and then we will have food throughout the year. That would be a perfect idea.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that, because Acacia Moyo's sort of seed program,
no pun intended.
Exactly. But the very first thing that we intend to do is develop a community vegetable garden, actually on land that we'll be leasing from Mr. Parmisa. It will be a traditional vegetable garden, but we also, one of our main paths will be to make this a showcase for very state-of-the-art methods of growing food. For instance, a mobile farm, which can be built in a container, which uses much less water than normally, but produces the same or a better crop, using hydroponics. There are all kinds of new methods. I saw something the Japanese have invented, I don't know what it's called, but where they invented a sort of seed bed that you just lay on the ground and you make it moist, and lo and behold, tomatoes and pumpkins and all kinds of things appear. So worldwide, people are dealing with these issues, and Acacia Moyo wants to reach a point where we can invite these experts and make our campus, as we call it, the Parmisa campus, a kind of showcase so that other communities in Kenya and anywhere can come and learn and participate. And we ourselves, we're not experts. We need experts to help us. Even Nixon, I've been talking to him about nutrition for many years. And when I talked to him on the phone a few months ago and I said, you know, how about a vegetable garden? He said to me, but I already have a vegetable garden. So Mr. Parmisa has of his own accord started this vegetable garden. People should understand that the Maasai are traditionally nomadic people. They have never grown food. So now that they are forced to be sessile, now comes the need for growing food.
Now, when you were nomadic and you weren't growing food, were you eating wild food, like wild vegetables and fruits?
Yeah, sometimes wild fruits. But mostly, we just, as a nomadic community, we purely believe on livestock, you know, for meat and for milk. You know, everything is purely livestock. But now, because of these challenges that are coming up, the decrease in the number of livestock of a particular area because of the drought, then we also now need an alternative.
One of the things that you do, and you talked about it in the context of when you allow lions to flourish, that's good for tourism. What does the tourism look like there, and how do you make sure that it is not destructive of the very ecosystem that you're trying to conserve?
It's because when tourists visit our area, they buy the beads from women in that village. So women get money, and this money goes direct to the community. And we've been partnering with some of the organizations like the Wildlife Foundation. And the Wildlife Foundation are paying some of the money to the community so that they can open up their lands. And these are benefits that the community is getting directly. We are now actually on the process. We've set up our community conservancy that is called Naretunoi, mean working together, to see whether we can be able to attract tourists to come to our area and pay the conservancy fee, and the money will directly go to the community. So now we want to use what we have, like the resource of wildlife, and attract the tourists to come to our area as a way of generating some income. And maybe in future, we might have some ecotourism project in our area where we will host them. They will spend a few nights in our area and create employment to the community and generate some of the money that directly go to the community, like paying school fees, paying medical bills to the local community, and empower our community economically.
Do you talk to other conservationists who are doing similar things in other parts of Africa or in other parts of the world?
Yeah, we've actually been doing some tours to other areas that have been successful doing some of those projects, like Masai Mara and Amboseli and even Samburu. And these are areas where the Maasai are geographically occupying. And they've been doing this, and some of these projects have really been successful. We've seen how it has impacted the community life. We've seen how it has changed the community life and how even the education level at the community. We've seen some of the infrastructure, like good hospitals, good schools, and even the continuation of the from the primary level to the secondary level and even to the university. A lot of kids from those areas have benefited from this project, and they've gone to school. And we always encourage them that if they go, wherever they go, they have to come back and share and change the life of the local community, because the community needs them.
You talked at the beginning about some of the traditions that have gone by the wayside, like underage marriage, and one of the things that you're promoting is real equality between male and female.
Yes.
How's that going? Is it happening? Is society changing a little bit or a lot because of that?
Yeah, it's changing. And actually, some of the results that we've been seeing is, if you go to a local primary school, if you compare the number of female teachers and male, the female are high. Because we are now telling them that all these kids can be a resource to a community. If you go to a training school to be a teacher, there is no exam you do for men and exam for girls. Exam is one. If you get a national ID, it's the same. Now even our constitution says one-third rule, and we are still thinking that they should even be 50-50, because we all preach now equality. So what we are telling the community now is, what a boy child can do for you, even a girl child can do for you. If a boy can be a doctor, even a girl can be a doctor. So we cannot separate them. And we always make jokes and tell them, if you marry a girl who is a doctor, that's a big boost to your family. If you are married a teacher, it's a big boost to your family. And these are the things that now we are telling them. And we've seen, we've really been able to talk to some of the young girls, and even them, they are now actually a voice of the community. You know, they are telling the community that we can also do better even than these boys. The other issue is now is about the inheritance, because many people think that if you don't, you marry off your girl, it's like you send away a burden, in quotes, away from you. But if you keep them at your home, you have to give them land and all that. But the good thing, we have a good example of some of the girls now who have gone to school and they've got a good job, and now they are buying land, and they are actually now even supporting their families more than just boys, girls. So we've seen some of the results of some of the things that we've been doing. I remember last year we were talking with Kenny about the two girls who wanted to do education. We rescued them from the early marriage, and we were lucky to, we got someone who supported them. Now they're in school, they're in boarding school. One of them, a few weeks ago before I came here, she went to represent the school at the county level. She's the only one who got that opportunity to go and represent the school at the county level on cross-country running. So there are so many people there who just need an opportunity to excel in life. It's only that opportunity has not come. But once they get that opportunity, they utilize it and they make change. They change their life and they change the life of the community.
You're talking about rural communities which are grazing-based and land-based, and you're talking about universities and cities, and those can often be two different cultures that can come in conflict. How do you mitigate conflicts that might arise between urban and rural mindsets and cultures and values?
That's actually one of the things we do training at the early stage. And actually, sometimes even you see someone is marrying and maybe is working in the city. What we normally do is we tell them, yes, you have a family, but your family, if the wife is not working, then they will stay in the village. You go work in the city, because that's a way of bringing back that person to the village. We always tell them, nobody will develop our area except our own people. So you work in the city, but you have to come back to the village. We want your ideas on how to develop our village. We want your opinion on different issues. We want you to go to a local primary school and talk to the kids, motivate them, tell them that you came from our village, you went to ABCD, and now you've come back, and you want to show them that there is a positive side of our community. So we've always have those challenges that many people want to go and work to the city, but we always remind them that there's a bigger society and a community that needs them, because we believe that a child belongs to a community. That's what, if you find them by the roadside doing something wrong, every parent has a right to correct them, because we always believe that a child belongs to a community, and it is a responsibility of a community to make sure that that child grows the way the community and the society wants.
I think it's really very interesting is the structure of Maasai community, which is very different to our structure because it's in age groups. So you grow up, your community is not just the people around you, but every other Maasai within a vast area that is in the same age group. And so, for instance, Nixon, you had a ceremony a few years ago at which you told me that 10,000 people showed up, which were all the people in Mr. Parmisa's age group who came for a particular ceremony. So when you have that feeling that you are supported and part of this much larger group, I think you're much more inclined to want to be part of, you don't want to be isolated from that group, because then you have nothing.
Yeah, because initiations and age groups are really very important in our culture. And they started at a childhood level. When someone is circumcised, because we do circumcision for boys at the age of 15 to 20, and all these people are grouped in one age group, one age set. So you grow up together knowing you are like brothers. The children of these people of my age group, they all call me the father. It doesn't matter whether they live in this world. If I ask you what is the age group of your father, and I know I'm the same age group with your father, those children are like my children. They have to call me a father. So the community and our initiation processes have helped us to bond and become one thing. And like that particular ceremony, we did it and we became junior elders. If now we want to do a particular decision we want to do in a community, we all have to come together. We have age groups. If we want, for example, to elect one of us, we all support him because it's a decision of our age group, and we support him and we say, this is a person we have to support. So these are just bonds that were put in place by our four grandfathers to make sure that people work together. Even livestock, the way we mark the ears of our livestock tells you which clan you come from. And they direct you. They tell you which family you are supposed to marry and which one you're not supposed to marry. If you have someone of your clan, it doesn't matter whether they are 100 miles away from you, as long as you have the same earmark for your livestock, then that's your community, that's your clan. It's like telling you these are your brothers. You are not supposed, for example, to marry from that particular family. So the way that people are supposed to be and to live, it's clearly written. Even everywhere, you can see by livestock tells you how you are supposed to do. By age group, those initiation tells you what you are supposed to do.
I just remembered a very seminal moment in my life, which is probably why I'm sitting here in Santa Fe at this moment. My parents came to Kenya as Jewish refugees in the 1940s. And I was born, as I said, just very near to where Nixon now lives. And my father had cattle. We were on a cattle ranch, and they were herded by the Maasai people. And I would always watch the milking in the evening. And one day, a young boy asked me if I knew my great-grandmother's name. And I didn't. And of course, being Jewish, there weren't any great-grandmothers anymore. And my parents, who came as refugees, never discussed that history with us. So that boy asking me that question, a Maasai boy, actually sent me on my life's path.
What happened? What did you do?
Well, of course, at that age, I was only about 6 or 7 then. But I've lived in London, I've lived in Germany for many years, I've made several documentary films, and everything is about that path. It's about identity as a white person living in Kenya, because even though I grew up in the colonial era, I don't think of our family as typical colonials, because we're not British. My parents came from Poland and Romania. And right from the start, I think, and particularly my father, who was a veterinarian, had an incredible understanding of the African culture and respect for it. And I think that was instigated in me, particularly as children. Our house in Nairobi was the only household in the 50s before independence where you would find African guests and Indian guests and guests of every nationality. So it's in my blood.
Very interesting. Well, I wanted to ask you both before we go how you think about the coming years, because the whole planet is in turmoil because of climate change and because of kind of crazy political upheavals everywhere and because of the population of the Earth and a lot of other factors. How do you think about stability and sustainability in the area where you are and the effects from the world around you?
That's an excellent question, and it's making me think. I trust the Maasai. They've come through so much, through the colonial era. They are one of the very few nations, I don't even want to say tribe, who up to this date have managed to retain their traditions. And I said before, move into the modern world with a very sophisticated knowledge of technology, combined with the kind of wisdom that Mr. Parmisa has illuminated just now about how you teach children to balance the use of technology with the traditions. So I have great faith in this particular community. I have great faith in the Wildlife Foundation, which has been going for about 18 years and has been extremely successful. I have great faith in other Kenyans like myself. We think of ourselves as white Africans, people who were born and raised there, who care very deeply about these issues. I think the challenges are enormous. The political situation in Kenya is extremely challenging, as it is anywhere else in the world. And the only thing you can do is to move forward step by step. You can't really think about those enormous issues because there's not much you can do about them except show true leadership, as Chief Parmisa does in an extraordinary way, and hope the world notices and hope we can all gain something from this. That's my aspect on it.
Yeah, I know there are so many challenges, but let me say, as long as zebra stripe will never change, there will never come a time when a zebra will be black, we will never lose our identity, because the moment we lose our identity and our culture, then we will disappear. And these are some of the things that we are telling the community. Even for us to have a community leader, there is a process of having someone as a community leader. You can't just wake up and pick someone as a community leader. We consult. We have wise people in our community that we consult. And the reason why we do that is because we believe that leadership is everything. If you have the right people in leadership, they will guide the community in the right way. And leaders with vision. You know, if you have a leader who has no vision for the community, then they will perish. It's just, it's possible to be a leader, but you don't have a vision. And the destiny will just be a ditch. So our processes of having leaders, the people to lead the community, are so powerful that, you know, we will always have the people to give us the right direction. And I think in many challenges that will come, but we will overcome because we have mechanism in place to make sure that we'll all always be together. And the decision that we make as a community is a decision that will affect our community in a positive way. We don't look at an individual. We look at the bigger community.
Are women coming into leadership roles?
Yes. Like, for example, now the Member of Parliament for my constituency is a female. Yes. And we have all these, even other positions, because there is a gender rule, the one-third gender rule. If there is a 5 position to be given out, 2 has to be women. So automatically these things are coming. And these are the results of some of the struggle that we've been actually pushing, because we all believe that they can perfectly do. There are some of the things that females do that men cannot do. And when we have this equality, the whole community moves forward.
Nixon Parmisa is a Maasai assistant chief. Kenny Mann they're both with Acacia Moyo. Is there a website that people can find more information?
There is. It's still under construction because we're very new, but there is one. It's acaciamoyo.org. And that's Acacia, A-C-A-C-I-A. MOYO.org. And I just want to mention that Nixon is our Maasai program director. He is our partner, and we defer and refer to him in everything, because I personally want to be part of that community. I don't want to be seen as an outsider, right, Nixon?
Yes.
My brother lives right there. To me, this is family. And Tony Carlson, who's a co-founder, also lived in Kenya for many years and has a deep-seated desire to be back there and to be doing this kind of work. So I think the cohesion is sort of magical and happened at the right moment in history.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.